Desert Island Discs. Each week, a well-known person is asked the question, if you were to be cast away alone on a desert island, which 8 gramophone records would you choose to have with you? As usual, the castaway is introduced by Roy Plumley.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? On our desert island this week is a very well-known person in the entertainment profession. For many years, he was a greatly loved music hall star. He's also a producer, a journalist, and a theatrical manager. It's Wee Georgie Wood. Now, I've introduced you as Wee Georgie Wood because that's the name so many millions of people know you by, but I believe that for years you never liked that Wee. You just liked to be Georgie Wood.
No, that's true. Well, the change came because a lady in Australia, in East Manly, actually, New South Wales, she wrote me that she'd enjoyed a programme on television, the story of Wee Georgie Wood. Then she sent me some press cuttings about it. And it was all about a little train in Tasmania that is used to service the tin mines there and is known as Wee Georgie Wood. Then on August the 12th, when I had an accident and busted my kneecap and I was in hospital, I had so many letters to Wee Georgie Wood from people that I didn't know at all. But they came to Wee Georgie Wood. Mother, what's been the matter with me? Wee Georgie Wood is something to be proud of. Now I insist on being called Wee Georgie Wood.
I think you're right. Now, do you think you could bear the isolation on this island for a long time?
Yes, I think so. I'm a pretty self-contained person.
What was your plan in choosing your 8 records to take with you?
Most of the records I've chosen are by people who I think don't date, not just nostalgic, but people who live on forever. They people the place for me.
Yes.
They're people I've known. Well, that was the general idea.
Who was the first one?
Clara Butt singing Abide With Me.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose this?
Well, it was the first record I ever had. Remind me of very many cup finals. And can't have Stanley Matthews on the desert island with me. I can think of his memorable cup final when he won his cup medal. And, not only that, you know, it's a pretty nice line, help of the helpless, to have on a desert island with you.
Abide with me, fast falls the eventide, the darkness deepens, Lord, with me. When other helpers fail and comforts flee, O thou who changest not, abide with me. I need thy presence.
Dame Clara Butt singing Abide With Me. What's your second choice?
My second choice is Al Jolson. Al Jolson singing Keep Smiling at Trouble. 1943, in the Hotel Aletti in Algiers. I entertained it. And I was sitting there with Gracie Fields, and Al, whom I'd known for many years, took me over in one corner, and he said, well, I guess I'm a forgotten man. These young guys won't even remember me. Well, we were a friend for very many years. No one keeps smiling at trouble, because in 1923, when they opened the Liverpool Empire with a Julian Wiley production, and Julian was one of my producers that I love very much, and George Baker, who was Honorary Secretary of the Savage Club for so many years, he sang this very number. So he's got all sorts of associations. And, Jolie sings it, well, you ain't heard nothing yet. You listen to this, boy.
Keep smiling at trouble, for trouble's a bubble, and bubbles will soon go away. with never a sadness and nothing but gladness. We'd weary of life in a day.
Al Jolson singing Keep Smiling at Trouble. Where were you born?
I was born over a pawnbroker's shop kept by my father in Gerowantine. I was in Gerowantine up to the age of 6 weeks, then I left the place. Not that I didn't like it, but I was always restless, so I went to Sunderland.
How old were you when you made your first appearance in public?
My first professional appearance, I'd be five. I used to do the church anniversary concerts, and they had their Sunday school treats at the Victoria Hall grounds at Seaham Harbour. And I was put up to sing and recite, and my Auntie Maggie stood on the outside of the crowd, and she threw a penny at me when I'd finished, and then all the others threw their money. So I really was receiving money at as an early age as that, wasn't I?
Yes, indeed. I believe by the age of 12 you were top of the bill.
Well, before that.
Before that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But when I was 10, I was with Levy and Cardwell's Juvenile Pantomime Company.
Yes.
And in one of my scenes I had a couple of gollywogs, one of them. They famously became eventually. They didn't have to do anything. And he was booked in those days because his father had two theatres that we could get dates at. His name was Stanley Jefferson. He became Stan Laurel of Laurel and Hardy.
Oh,
but I was the star of that company.
Mm.
By the way, Chaplin likes this story, Charlie Chaplin. He speaks of when we were playing at Eldham, and he was there with the 8 Lancashire lads, and he said he used to look at the bills and see wee Georgie Wood in the Sleeping Beauty and wonder, would I ever be as big as that? And I said, and were you? Charlie loved to tell that one.
And very early you began to travel the world, to Africa, South Africa, the United States.
Played South Africa first in 1909 at an enormous salary, and there it is, £145 a week.
Mm-hmm. When did you start playing those famous sketches of yours of the little boy and his mother?
Well, 1917 and 18, I was doing a play called Some Detective, and Dolly Harmer was in that play with me.
Yes, you had a long partnership with Dolly Harmer, who played your mother.
From then till she died 5 years ago.
You wrote all those sketches yourself?
All excepting The Black Hand, and that was written by Weston and Lee.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's break off here and have the third record.
As I'm a Geordie, I come from the Wear side. Born in Java and brought up in Sunderland, you know. Why, aye, man. And, Owen Brannigan. Now, he's done a recording of a number that I used to do at concerts and things, and I fancied myself in it because it was written by another pal of mine, Sterndale Bennett, Leaning.
I'm leaning on the gate, beside the pond that lies beside the sign, the hedge where my old dog would play. It's just a cause. From there I see the sunlight glinting through the tree upon the grave where he do lie.
Owen Brannigan singing Leanin'. Now, we've talked about your music hall successes as a turn, but I think you were almost equally well known for your pantomimes. You played in one almost every year right from the beginning of your career, didn't you? Which is your favourite pantomime?
Humpty Dumpty. It was created specially for me, and I liked, because he was an ageless character.
You did a great deal of forces entertaining overseas during the war, for which you were decorated with the OBE. After the war, you began to broaden your activities, didn't you? You presented quite a lot of straight plays.
Oh, I did it before the war. I was doing that, I mean, and during the war as well. I mean, I did The Moon Is Down at the Whitehall Theatre.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that with Bernie Delphon. King Hawken came to the first night. He was looking for me all over to get into the picture with him, but he was so big he couldn't see me. I slipped in. I'm the little face beside his knee.
And you presented Sir Donald Wolfit and Ibsen's The Master Builder,
that's
I remember.
Right.
And your journalism, you've been a show business columnist for many years, haven't you?
Yes, in 1927 I was writing regularly. Well, I wrote before that. My first column, oddly enough, was written in 1915 for the Old Performer, when I wrote about the sinking of the Lusitania as we felt it as we were on the deck of the Baltic. And Alec Lauder, Sir Harry Lauder's brother, was standing with me, and the news came through about the Lusitania being sunk. And of course, it was Alec's daughter, Greta. She was the one who took care of Sir Harry. Let's have Sir Harry Lauder for the next one, because it was in 1917, Willie Scott, Dolly Harmer's husband, was playing in Three Cheers with him at the Shaftesbury Theatre, and the news came through about Captain John Lauder, his only son, being killed in action.
Mm.
Lauder with the tradition, the show must go on. Yeah, let's have Keep Right On to the End of the Road.
If you're tired and weary, still journey on till you come to your happy abode, where all you love and you dream and go will be there at the end of the road.
Sir Harry Lauder singing Keep Right On Till the End of the Road. Well, now, Mr. Wood.
Mr. Wood?
Yes?
Oh, Mr. Plumley. May I call you Roy?
Yes, please do.
Right, you may call me George. I like to be asked, you know, but just want to get on that basis, right?
I'd
right.
like to, George. Now, in the last few years, we've seen the virtual disappearance of the old music hall. Do you think television is responsible, mainly?
It's had its factor, as it has with a lot of things, but I don't think that was the main thing. I think that music hall was going before that, because there are no training grounds anymore, no juvenile schools where they learned their jobs, Casey's Court and all those sort of troops.
Yes. Hey, you went through that mill yourself, George. Was it a hard life? Do you think it was a suitable life, a good life for young children?
Well, I mean, get right back to the first one. If you want a music hall, it's like acrobats. You've got to catch them young and train them.
Mm.
Personally, I hated it, and I never dared let anybody know, because my mother loved seeing me doing it, and so did everybody else, and made it all the harder for me.
Yes. Well, we were talking about television just now. You've been producing some television yourself, haven't you?
The Rat Show that did for the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't the actual producer, but virtually. And in America, but not over here, no.
Yes. And you've been writing for American television, too.
Oh, yeah. I get quite a kick out of seeing some of the things, especially on the BBC, some of the scenes that I've sailed under a different name altogether in America, and then seeing them over here on the screen.
Now, you had a long and eventful career in many branches of the entertainment profession. Have you still any one main ambition still unfulfilled?
Yeah, I don't want to be a big shot, but I'd like to do something in television, not exactly in the way of producing, but kind of advising.
Mm.
And I would love to do the equivalent of a Jack Parr, Mike Wallace spot. You know, the late night interviews they have in New York where they get somebody and they really grill them and put them through the mill. I would like to do one of those and show really how gentle some of the present inquisitors are.
Well, someone may be listening who can further that ambition. Let's have another record.
All right, well, this time we're going to have Noel Coward and Gertrude Lawn. They're both very, very good friends. I saw Gertie give her last performance in The King and I in New York. And my memory of Noel goes back to 1912 at the Coliseum. He was a little boy in a play with Sir Charles Horty, a little foul play. And I was big name, came and said, could I get him a ride on the revolving stage? I called the assistant stage manager, Mr. Munn, and I said, let's have a ride. Then I took him home in my car to Hampstead. I never knew that was Noel Coward until the first night of Cavalcade at Drury Lane, when he came and told me. Let's have the scene from Private Lives.
Someday I'll find you, moonlight behind you, true to the dream I am dreaming. As I draw near you, you smile a little smile. For a little while, we shall stand hand in hand.
An excerpt from Private Lives, played by Noel Coward and Gertrude Lawrence, which brings us now to number six.
Well, number six is Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham. I met Sir Thomas at the late Sir Louis Stirling's home, where I met a lot of celebrities. That brings that back. When I was in South Africa producing pantomime, they gave me a symphony orchestra, and I decided to start Cinderella pantomime with the Volynov twins dancing a mime ballet as a prologue to Cinderella, to Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. So that I must have.
The opening of Schubert's unfinished symphony, Sir Thomas Beecham conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Now a question that must be asked, George. How good do you think your qualifications are as a castaway? Could you look after yourself?
Oh, yes, I think so. I never do, so I think I could. I'm tidy as I like. It wouldn't matter. I'd be all right.
Mm-hmm. Is food and luxury, good food and luxury, important to you in life?
Not a bit. Doesn't matter a bit. Long as I have something like Sauveronica steak there and crepe Suzette.
A simple desert island diet. Yeah. Well, let's have record number 7.
Well, if I was there, I'd naturally want to feel that I had something that was really beautiful English being spoken. And I can think of nothing better, and I sort of feel a personal application to it, of Sir John Gielgud reciting Seven Ages.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school, and then a lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then the soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth.
The Seven Ages of Man speech from As You Like It by Sir John Gielgud, which brings us now to your last record, What You've Been Saving Till the End.
Misha Elman, very old friend again, playing Raff's Cavatina. In a sketch I did called Half a Clown, I used Raff's Cavatina as the closing milos, we call it, sort of background music.
Yes.
When the leader of the orchestra in the provincial places was particularly good as a violinist, I used to change the ending and walk off as a little clown, and the light, the spotlight, came from me and went on to the leader, and he played Raff's Cavatina and had his hour of glory, and believe you me, I got more applause, as you usually do, for somebody else's effort than anything I'd done for myself. And then, with memories of Misha, I get them both.
Misha Elman playing Raff's Cavatina. Well, there are your 8 records, George. If you could only take one with you, which would it be?
Oh, I think certainly Nerl and Gerty. And someday I'll find you. If you're on a desert island, you've got to have some hope, haven't you?
And you're allowed to take one luxury with you.
I suppose having 8 records, I couldn't take the BBC gramophone library, could I?
I'm afraid not, no.
Right, well, then I'll settle for lots of scribbling pads and ball pens, and I will write the biographies of ever so many people. And believe you me, if ever I'm rescued and they're read, they'll throw me overboard right away.
Well, you'll let me read it, I hope, even if these uncensored revelations aren't published. And one book you may take apart from the Bible and Shakespeare.
I'd like to take Walter de la Mare's Memoirs of a Midget. I read it and thought it was a wonderful book. Always meant to read it again, but felt I wanted to read it just alone. This would be the opportunity.
Right. And thank you, wee Georgie Wood, for letting us hear your choice of Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you for letting me on your program at last. I've waited a long time for this.
I don't know how you got out of it so long.
All right, thank you.
Goodbye, everyone.